attention. I can't get no call to action, but I try and I try and I try.
Hello and welcome to Call to Action, the go-to podcast for anyone trying to make sense of the world of marketing, business and beyond. In an industry that is a minefield of utter bollocks, we aim to capture our heroes and allies from the front line to have a chinwag with. It's like Pokemon Go, with the single but vital exception that it's not a short-term bandwagon of shite. It's brought to you by Gasp and I'm Giles Edwards. This week, we've been out every night committing crimes, twocking Nokias, cussing at ducklings, stealing the dust caps off your dad's tyres, all to attract the attention of South London Batman himself, and this week's guest, Kazim Jamal. A comedian so entertaining he almost makes you hate yourself slightly less for being on Instagram all the time. Kazim has been liberally lubricating the amusement pipes on the BBC, Comedy Central and the Mobo Awards. Before comedy grabbed him by the earlobe and dragged him over to the funny side, Kazim spent years working in the education sector, primarily with children with special needs and in alternative education, making him humorous and kind-hearted enough to make us all feel really bad about our own decisions, especially the terrible stuff we said to those ducklings. Kazim says it's difficult to be a comedian. The performing aspect and the writing aspect is not the hardest part. Welcome to the show, Kazim.
Hey, thanks for having me, man.
Right, seven quick fires. Batman or Spider-Man?
Batman.
Denver Broncos or London Broncos?
London Broncos.
Too easy, right? On stage or on socials?
On stage.
Nimbus 2000 or the Thunderclart 2000?
Thunderclart 2000.
The Office or Afterlife?
The Office.
Waze or Google Maps?
Waze.
Oh man, these are too easy. Right, last one. This is an ode to Pizzagate. Ocean's 11 or the Lewisham 6?
The Lewisham 6.
Oh man, you sailed through though. The quickest of all the quickfires.
Wicked.
Amazing. Nice one. So Kazim, as you know, we always like to ask guests like what they, you know, what they've done to get to where they are now. I said only a moment ago that the path you've trodden is fairly uncommon, right?
It's a funny story, really. It never really looked like getting to where it is now, where I'm a stand-up comedian. I was born in Southeast London, the old Greenwich Hospital. I think it's a library now, and lived there my whole life, living in Lewisham and then moving out a little bit further. I went to a private primary school whilst living in Lewisham. So there was a big contrast in life there where I feel like I've learned two sides of the game, essentially. And then from there, me and my mum, we moved a bit further adrift of the, like, the hub of Southeast London. And that's when I started playing rugby in primary school. And my PE teacher said I had a talent for it. I was bigger than everyone at the time. Not anymore. I'm 5'9" and a half. that half means a lot to me. Growing up, you know, early years, I wasn't interested in sport, wasn't interested in football or anything like that. But then I won a race at school and kind of fell in love with competition and kind of, you know, the positive reinforcement I got from that, the attention I got from that, you know, because otherwise it was just negative attention from bad behavior. When we moved a bit further out, it was more rugby than it was football. I joined a rugby team and all my aspirations from there was to become a professional rugby player. And that was in rugby union. A friend of mine, a teammate of mine said, come and play rugby league during the summer to keep fit. That was a much more physical game. And I enjoyed the physicality of it much more than rugby union. I realized like the rugby league pathway was much more straightforward than the rugby union pathway. And I think in my first season, I got picked up by, at the time it was Harlequins Rugby League. They were the sister club to Harlequins Rugby Union. I went for a trial. I got in. In that moment, in the first meeting we had as academy prospects, they let us know there was only like 6 to 8 professional contracts up for grabs. And there was a couple of people there that played for England Academy. So we knew a few contracts had already been spoken for. We got to the end of the season. I went for my meeting with my mum, and they right in the room, they just offered me a 2-year deal at 16. So then at 19, I went straight into men's rugby, played that up to about 26. My last pre-season, I had a real trouble with somebody else having the final say over my future or my performance or whether I'm in the team. Because at the end of the day, it's like any job, really. You can work your socks off. At the end of the day, it's your manager or the powers that be that decide how quickly or if you progress at all. And I had a real problem with someone having that kind of authority over my future. Because the thing about rugby as well is that it's not a high-paying job unless you're at the top end of it. I was playing semi-professional rugby, so we still had day jobs and stuff like that. So I was listening to podcasts in the car and in the gym, and I was listening to a lot of comedy podcasts. And that's when I realized comedians, they create material that they try and work. They work it out to figure out, does this joke work, or how, if it's not working, how do I make it work? Because before that, my only thought about stand-up was Eddie Murphy Raw, and I thought he came out in that leather suit and everything he said was coming off the top of his head, like 4 hour and a bit or whatever it was. I thought that was all improvised, and I said I could never do that, that's crazy. But then now podcasts have opened the window to say, no, we actually write this and figure it out. And I said, I think I could do that, even if it's, you know, not what where it's taken me today. And it coincided with a bit of relationship trouble, and I just wanted a complete hard reset, really, against everything that was going on in my life. I knew someone that had done stand-up. They said, go to an open mic. So in the November, December, I quote-unquote retired from rugby. And in the February of the following year, I'd done my first 5 minutes at an open mic. Fell in love with it on the spot. I said, I'll do this for the rest of my life. Even I had no idea of getting paid for it or anything like that. I was like, this is the control over something I wanted. I've got my 5 minutes. Nobody can stop me. This is my material. As long as I sign up and I don't say anything too crazy, like no one can really stop you. Whether they laugh or they don't laugh at an open mic level, this is mine. It's my 5 minutes, and it's mine. Somebody that ran an open mic said, you know, you might have something here. You need to start treating it like a job. Start doing it like as many times a week as you can. That's what I did. And it just went from strength to strength. Now sitting here talking about it, looking back on it, it's been quite a fun journey to get to this now.
What's interesting to me immediately is just like, is that kind of ownership that you saw as much as anything else. Not that there's, like, obviously there's no right answer when you ask anyone these sorts of questions, but I guess you can't help but assume the motivations that take people to where they are. And so I kind of assumed that there'd be all sorts of influences, aside from obviously Eddie Murphy Raw, which is one of the best gigs of all time. But I assume there was more examples like that that perhaps drove you to it. And I didn't realize there was so much around the being in control of your own destiny or your own thing, if you like, that was the real motivation.
Yeah, because what it was is that, you know, throughout my rugby career, I'd had loads of different coaches and managers and stuff like that. And what I found is that some coaches would pick a team based on what they saw. You know, it doesn't matter who you are, where you've come from. If you trained well, you did all the right things, you played in the game and did well, you were in the next week, which is fair. And then there were some coaches where it was like, well, I might get a few people on loan who don't really care about the club as much or aren't really willing to put their body on the line as much because they could go back to their Super League club the following week or a few months later, or these guys are my mates. And, you know, and that's not me being sour about it. That's just what it was at the time. And not just for me, but for other players as well. And the coach I had at the time, I was just like, this guy doesn't care really. He just wants to put in who he wants to put in. For example, somebody went on holiday to Australia for a month, didn't train, was drinking, eating, whatever they wanted, flew back to England at the end of their holiday in the morning from Australia and was in the starting lineup. Whereas I'd been there for the whole month, eating right, going to the gym, training my ass off. And it was that kind of thing of like, it doesn't really matter what I do for this coach.
I can't win.
Yeah, I can't win. So with the stand-up, yeah, it was a real enabler to go, no, this is yours. This is mine. This is my material. All I've got to do is sign up. And then if I sign up, they're going to give me the thumbs up and say, you're in. That was it. It was no, are you my friend? You know, where have you come from? That was it. It was just no other really influences at that time, apart from, like I say, the podcasts that gave me the insight onto how the comedy industry worked, especially at that level. There was no other influence. I never once watched a comedian and was, I've seen Chris Rock live before that. I saw comedy live in the States before that, in New York. Nothing really stopped me and was like, that, I want to do that. It didn't inspire me like that. It was more of, I've got my ideas, I've put in the work, and now this is mine. No one can tell me anything.
That's awesome. And then going back, like just quickly going back even further, like at school, was it sport and rugby that was the thing that you kind of gripped and wanted to kind of pursue? Because clearly when you were you know, younger than you started to sort of play and you know, go Harlequins League, was there anything that interested you to pursue, like career-wise? Did you have any ideas of what that might look like?
Pretty much throughout my whole school, primary and secondary school life, people always pushed me towards drama. So that was kind of like an underlying thing. But I, believe it or not, I get quite self-conscious and shy when it comes to like acting. I think with stand-up, you know, that's yourself. I'm not pretending to be anyone. No one's really judging my performance and how I can portray a character. So I never really delved too much into drama. I did do it as a GCSE and stuff like that. It was really the sports that drove everything. Initially, it was athletics because that was what I excelled in at first. I used to want to be a 100 meter or a 200 meter sprinter. Like, I broke all the records at all my schools for track and field. And that was the drive. But then when I found rugby, it kind of coincided with this, you know, like, it's such a physical game. Like, I can't get in trouble for like snapping somebody in half. Like, in fact, you get a pat on the back. And I was like, that was really cool. There was that platform that allowed me to express any frustrations, or as well as getting like the well done's for doing a good job. But I also did taekwondo for a long time. So there was kind of like a pattern emerging here of like, this young man has, I don't want to say like an aggression to get out, because I wouldn't say I was an aggressive child, but there was obviously things outside of life, family life, where you might have frustrations. Like anyone that gets their kid into martial arts or rugby, or boxing, this is a good way to channel that energy. And that's really what it was. It was an outlet that I could channel this energy. I didn't like sitting down.
Largely healthy, right? A healthy way of doing it. And you hear, like, you know, there's no shortage of stories of people who drop out at any level of pursuing sports, or even post like a professional career, who find themselves going down all sorts of, you know, troubled way, whether it's gambling, alcohol, whatever other vice it might be, because it is an outlet that should be encouraged, right? All sorts of sports.
Yeah, for sure. You know, and it teaches you a lot of things as well. Teamwork, dedication, hard work. So I definitely have those ethics that I've taken over from sports into like the creative industry now.
Yeah. One thing I wanted to ask is, in the research, I noted that you, in terms of like what your family thought about your move, your mum said apparently when you told her you were going to try and become a stand-up comedian, don't do it, you're not funny.
Yeah. And I remind her about that all the time.
Yeah, I bet you
all
do.
All the time. In fact, I took her on the first 2 weeks of the cruise, and I just did, and I was like, remember when you said I wasn't funny? Remember that? She said, don't do it, you're not funny. And then when I work with people like Judy Love, Mo Gilligan, Richard Blackwood, There's my mum going, can I come? And I'm, no, you said I wasn't funny, so you can't come. I do. I always bring my mum. In fact, you know, even though she said I wasn't funny, which kind of lit a few, like, there's one thing about me and my mum. If someone tells us we can't do something, we'll put all our energy into proving, in fact, I can do it and you're wrong. But on the flip side of that, in the open mic circuit, a lot of the times you have to bring somebody to be an audience member. They're called bringer gigs, and you have to bring a person, which kind of defeats the purpose of the person running the show calling themselves a promoter, because you haven't really promoted anything. But my mum would be my bringer a lot of the time. So even though she didn't think I was funny, she still supported the mission, so to speak.
Amazing. She must have changed her mind though now, right?
Yeah, 100%.
Is she a tough crowd?
She would still remind me, well, you know, I was your bringer way back then. You know, I remember I still supported you way back when. I still did it, didn't I? I was still the person that, so don't forget about that. So kind of fun back and forth we have.
We interrupt this podcast to announce that we will never interrupt this podcast with ads. Ads that awkwardly nudge you to contact the pod's host, Giles Edwards. Only last week, some pod listening companies did just that, calling for guidance on building a funnel. But we're not asking you to do that. Nope. Anyway, back to the show.
How did it kind of evolve? I mean, I know you said you were listening to podcasts, then you did your stand-up, and then you went on the, the circuit. Like, in the quickfires, we intentionally asked on stage or on socials, because, like, I don't know what you call it, the landscape or whatever you want to call it of comedy has kind of fragmented loads in the last decade or so. And because of stuff like Instagram, which we should definitely talk about, you're able to kind of have these really short, often 5-10 second, like, stand-up gigs, put them out into the world, see how people react. Like, do you have a preference between the two? And do you see them as, like, entirely different, or are they much the same thing?
In terms of, like you said, being on stage or on socials, I much prefer being on stage, because when I'm on stage, I feel that, you know, like in life in general, like we kind of are reserved to a certain extent, some people more than others. But, you know, you go on a first date, you go to an interview, or around your colleagues, or around the in-laws or whatever, there's a reservedness. Even if you're the most wildest person, you know, there's probably some things you're gonna keep back. You know, not everyone. I was just watching the Charlie Sheen documentary. That's someone that's just out there for everyone to see. But in terms of regular people, there's a reservedness, and I find that quite a lot with myself. I keep a lot of things I want to say in. I keep a lot of things I want to do in. When I'm on stage, that is probably the one place in the whole world where I go, I can just be 100% me, unapologetically me. All I've got to do is make sure it's funny, but I can be me. I can tell you what I don't like. If someone shouts out, I can say, shut the fuck up. You know, there's so many outlets for me on stage. Whereas, you know, so if you're walking down the street and someone says something to you and you say, shut up, that could escalate into something. But on stage, It's just a freedom that I have that is kind of unparalleled.
That's probably quite a good, like, energy to have, right? I imagine that fuels you, because, like, I also want to ask where the line is, or if there even is a line with that, because whether it's you, like, I recently saw you joking about you love watching people just miss a train, right? That's a kind of, like, fairly inoffensive thing to share. Like, how far do you push it? Or do you literally just go up and there's just no holds barred? You just talk about whatever it is and just bring your opinion to stage.
So for me, especially in the early years of my career, people kept labeling me as like a raw comedian or an edgy comedian. I didn't think I was saying anything that edgy. You know, I was just, I could always cite people that made a million times, you know, edgier jokes than I did. That's also another part of my character that I enjoy, and I've enjoyed since I was a kid of beings of that kind of, like, excitement of, this is something I know I probably shouldn't do, but let me see if I can get away with it, kind of thing. You know, whether it's knocking on somebody's door and running away, can we do it, can we get away with it, etc. So there is an excitement in me that goes, right, here's a joke, I wonder if I can pull this joke off. There's only ever been one time where it went horribly wrong, but other than that, I've because people always say I kind of tell my jokes with a cheekiness. You can tell that I'm not malicious. I don't mean anything by it, no matter who I'm talking about, black, white, tall, small, gay, straight, whatever. I'm not doing this because I don't like what I'm talking about. Whereas I think sometimes the audiences are very smart. They can tell very quickly and make their mind up on somebody, on the subjects they're talking about. Do you believe this? Do you actually in your heart think this? Or did you just think this was something funny to say? And people can make their mind up very quickly. But for me, in the grand scheme of things, when I write a joke, when I write something, it usually has to pertain to my life or something that I've been through. So for example, I have material on me and my son's mum. I always find it funny when we say we, because really, especially physically, the woman that goes through it, but we lost two pregnancies before our son was born. And that is something I took to the stage. And that's a really hard subject to navigate and make funny, but I figured it out. But it's not like I was in my house and just went, do you know what's really funny? Miscarriages. No, it was something that happened to me, so I want to talk about it. So there's things I talk about that might be a bit tough to navigate, you know, but it's really how did you make that funny? And you know, and this is personal to me. That's why I'm talking about. I didn't just walk around and think, what's a really terrible thing to make a joke about? It's actually something.
Yeah, well, do you know what? Kudos for bringing that to stage anyway, because I say we, me and my wife more so than me, have had a similar kind of experiences. And it was only when it happened to us a couple of times, we realized how common it really is. But actually, because people aren't talking about it, whether you do it through comedy or any other type, I don't know, I guess form of therapy, I guess, it's really important, right? So, you know, I think that's a good thing.
Yeah, and I don't talk out loud so much about, I know like this day and age is a lot, and it's good, a lot of things about, you know, men's mental health, speak out, blah, 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 blah. But I don't, and I think that's because I have an outlet and I can talk to a room full of people and go, well, this is something I've been through or I'm going through. And like you say, it's not something that, you know, you watch a lot of films and you see somebody get pregnant and they have the baby. And as men, or for me, I thought that's just how it worked. You get pregnant and you have the baby. I just thought, you know, that's what I've seen on TV and films. And then you go through it. And one thing I will say is that, you know, a lot of men don't talk about how they feel during that time. That's really what I'm doing. We've also, you know, speaking about it in a whole, this is something I felt, and you know, like I say, the real challenge is not bringing it to the stage, but ultimately at the end is that I've got to try and make this subject funny. And how do I do that? And it's not about making fun of miscarriages; it's actually making fun of my kind of way of thinking during those times.
Yeah, and I think humor's got such a great such a great tool for almost taking something really serious and, you know, often heartbreaking topic and dressing it up in a way that makes it easy to talk about. Because I think, especially like in our industry, so in like doing advertising and stuff, the pushback on using humor is, oh, we can't use humor because we're talking about something serious. And like the immediate thing that comes to mind is, this is a bit trivial, but there's a divorce law firm, and their business card and their letterheads and everything is like perforated right down the middle, so everything can be split in two as a kind of nod to like divorce proceedings and then the outcome. And it's such like a witty thing and memorable thing, and yet it's talking about what is probably one of the most difficult kind of emotional journeys that couples would go on, or certainly one of them. And so I always push back when people say like our product or our category or whatever is too serious to use humor, because as you've just said, you talked about miscarriage on stage. Like, I don't feel like it can get much more serious than that.
Yeah, I think humor is the great equalizer. You know, it's like everyone has the ability to. There's no barrier to entry on laughing. You know what I mean? So, and. If anyone thinks about probably the saddest time in their lives, like it might sound shocking. Some of the best laughs I've had have been at funerals, because that's how, as a family or as a unit, it's like, okay, there's a sad part coming, you know, and we're all feeling that emotion. And then somebody after, you know, it's all said and done and, you know, we've said goodbye to that person, someone cracks a joke or something happens. I remember one time, I was at a funeral and I remember smelling brandy. And I kept saying, I can smell. And my auntie was like, shush, shush, shush. And just poured some in my coffee. And that's how everyone was getting alcohol around in this church. And then my uncle dropped the bottle and it didn't smash. It did that like ting, ding, 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 ding. Like it cut through everything. And it was the funniest thing at the time. And even though we were all trying to hide this alcohol from other family members who would have looked down on us like, what, you're getting drunk? What? No. And it was hilarious. And
yeah,
that's what I mean. It's like some of the best laughs I've had have been at, and you wouldn't put the two together, but I think laughing can get you through so much. It's not to say that we've forgotten about something bad that's happened or anything like that. It's almost like I'm just taking a break from feeling this way about this topic. I'm just taking a quick break. I'm gonna have a laugh, and then sooner or later I can go back to grieving or mourning or stressing or figuring out, you know, am I going to get this job? Am I going to get into uni? But for 15 minutes, I'm going to take a break and just have a laugh about it.
Yeah. Weirdly, you've just reminded me of something I've completely forgotten. When I went to my wife's nan's funeral, probably 10 years ago now, and her uncle, Pete, who's just one of the funniest blokes you'll ever meet, albeit really unassuming with it, after the funeral, he came up to me and said, oh, Nanny Rose always wanted you to have this. And it was literally just a random piece of shit he found on the floor outside the church. It was just like a random stick or something stupid. And it was just so unexpected. There was something about it that just, I don't know, it was brilliant.
Yeah.
Not quite light for light, right? But
yeah. No. It's an amazing thing. And a good friend of mine, Emmanuel Sanubi, he told me something recently. He was like, are you on stage to get laughs or are you on stage to give laughs? And I think if you go on stage to give laughs, or you go up to somebody, like you said, at a funeral to give a quick laugh, that's an amazing thing that you're able to do. And I get a lot of messages after shows, you know, people talking about that, you know, this has happened to us as well, or I speak about something different and they think like, this is the first time I've seen my dad laugh at all or laugh about this subject that's happened to us. You're always going to get people that go, you shouldn't joke about that, but that's, you know, whatever, because it's doing more good than harm. There are some things across the board that I will not joke about, because I just don't think it's necessary. Like even the things recently that have been in the news, people were so fast to get online and make a joke. It's just like, I think that's a bit whack, you know. There's another thing about comedians is that they feel like they have to be funny all the time. You don't have to be funny all the time, man. Just relax, you know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Do you have to learn that though? Did you think that when you started?
Yeah, you do. You think, you know, whether you're with other comedians, whether you're online, whether you're with your friends, it's that you don't. Some of my friends are the funniest people in the world, and it's just like, I don't need to be funny right now. It's not a competition, you know. Everyone in the circle knows I'm funny, so I don't need to prove anything to anyone. I think when you start out, you're like, I need to be funny because this is what I'm trying to do. But once you realize that I can do it, you know, it's like Cristiano Ronaldo doesn't need to walk around doing kick-ups everywhere. Everyone knows he can do it. You know what I mean?
Like, so he probably does though, right?
He probably does, but everyone knows he can do it. And so if someone was in front of him doing kick-ups, he'd be like, yeah, good job. Yeah, I can do that too. But some people still, you know, you hang around with comedians and it's almost like if you take a step back, it's like everyone in the room is competing to get the funniest line. It's like no one's getting paid any extra to be funny in the green room. It's like, relax. They just be funny all the time, especially when something, whether you're for people or disagree with people, you have to be funny all the time just because something's happened.
Yeah. You said the hardest part isn't writing or performing, and I use that quite deliberately in the intro. What is the hardest thing about comedy?
For me, remembering why you started, because you start and it's so much fun, and then it becomes business at some point. If you're good enough, it becomes business. And then I did fall into a trap momentarily of of looking at my peers and being like, you know, before I had an agent, seeing people get signed, why have they got signed? I'm at least as funny as them. Why have they got signed and I haven't got signed? Why has this person got this and why are they in that club and I'm not in that club, but I'm funnier than they are? And you have to take a step back and go, oh, whoa, whoa, whoa. That's not why I started this, because that's why in my Instagram bio it says I'm just having fun, no matter
just
what.
Having
happened,
fun, yeah, just having that fun. Yeah, love it.
You know, and the only thing the money or the better gigs or the better opportunities allow me to do is to just keep having fun, keep making silly videos, keep writing jokes, keep, you know, all of that. I did fall into that trap of watching other people, and almost you see the older comedians, you see the bitterness in them. If their career didn't go the way their peers' careers went, and you see that, and you, I don't want to be that guy. So far, that was the hardest part. That was the hardest part of stand up. Alternatively, was doing it with a 9-to-5 job as well. Like the more thing that's common to everybody that might be listening is that having a dream or having something you're passionate about that you love that you wish you could do 24/7, and then having to go into a job that you care about. But you keep finding yourself in your office or at your desk, or, you know, if you drive the bus or whatever you're doing, just going, oh, I could be making jokes right now. I could be writing a sketch and filming a sketch and doing this and doing that.
And do you treat, like you mentioned, the just having fun on Instagram. Do you treat Instagram any different to your live on stage stand-ups? Like, do you use it more to, I don't know, because you could use it to test material, right? You get this like immediate feedback, which I think represents a problem in itself. I've spoken to people before who get kind of addicted to that immediacy, and almost it become a bit too dangerous to use that as like a fair assessment of if something works or not, because it's a different audience, it's a different format. And actually, you mentioned about doing drama earlier, and I suspected that maybe more of the drama side was coming out on Instagram, because if you just do a quick scroll, listeners, of your Instagram page, you'll see Batman, Harry Potter, Waze, which I've watched it honestly at least 7,000 times. You know, Love Island comes up, Frozen, like it's amazing. But is that like almost a separate type of gig in itself to the live on stage stuff you've been doing?
Yeah, yeah. Because if you go, and that's why I at my Instagram, I keep some stand-up stuff pinned to the top, just so that if anyone's come to my page and goes, I want to see this guy live, you know that there's a difference. I'm not coming out just as Batman. That's not happening. But there is definitely a difference. There was definitely an energy towards social media as well that I found myself, again, falling into that I didn't like. Especially when you go on a doom scroll and you see somebody that just like, I see so much nonsense. And people might look at my stuff and go, you're 31 years old, you're dressed up as Batman in your room. That's nonsense, mate. But I see so many things where it's like, I don't even know how you parlay that into, I don't know what you're trying to achieve here. Or maybe you're just, look, even now, just in that moment, I felt maybe you're just having fun too. Who am I to judge? But you see people do something so silly, like they lick a banana or something, and like whilst balancing on a hoverboard, and 500,000 views, and you're like, what? I'm actually trying to. I've got a skill here that I'm trying to. It's like, yeah, 3,000 views, and I was getting really annoyed about that, because social media can open up different doors for you as well. So it was a career goal of going like, we need to get over the line here with something. And all I ever wanted to do was get 10,000 followers and 10K views on a video. And
well, you smashed that a long ago.
Yeah. And then that's when you realize, like, this, although it does open up doors, it's just like, okay, I've done it now. What's, you know, okay, cool. I'm still just going to have fun with this. What I did find myself doing very recently is turning my view count off. I turned my view count off because I kept watching it. I kept, you know, comparing and being like, oh, this blah blah blah, blah, this didn't. Harry Potter did a 1.something million, and then if something got like 15,000 views, I'd be like, oh, I suck, man, because it didn't, you know. And then you got to remember again, no, you just, it doesn't matter. There are, like, again, key performance indicators I want to hit for each video, but again, if it doesn't, it's fine. I think, you know, social media is a bit fickle. You know, you put something up and it might stink.
100%. And do you know what? There's so much randomness about it. And it's the same with, it's the same again, like we go back to advertising. It's the same with that. Like there'll be a, like some random ad every now and then will go viral. And then all clients will say, oh, I want a viral idea like that one. You just think, you just like that sort of stuff isn't an exact science. And actually also there's, I think there's also a pop culture element, I think, to it where, and using the word pop probably makes sense. If you look at like the pop charts, for example, the number one is normally always bullshit. Like, okay, every now and then it's a good tune, maybe, but it's just like the masses like beige and grey. And actually, I think the more interesting spaces are like the more niche kind of, whether it's music, comedy, anything cultural, the people that are excelling in these little niches, to me, they're like, that's where the real talent tends to lie.
Yeah, for sure. That's what you have to like remind yourself, is that you don't want to be a, you don't want to be a flash in the pan. You don't want to just create some, and that's what I found myself doing sometimes, is being like, I'm just creating this just to, I'm not enjoying the process. I'm not enjoying filming it. I'm not enjoying any of it. And then I remember one night I sat down and I wrote on my whiteboard, I wrote three steps. I just wrote attention, skill, and then monetize. And then I just put like a loop around it to say, go back around. So if you look at my page, there's videos where you can see me just screaming in the street. And that was to go like, all right, just get their attention any way possible. And it was built out of frustration again. And that's how I felt. It was like, I just want to shout like, hey, I've got something over here. Take a look. And then that's when, again, I went, all right, now I always thought about Harry Potter. I still do watch Harry Potter a lot. And I just thought, imagine like everyone's been to school. How did I go to that? Like, what if Harry Potter was from South London? Like, what if Harry Potter was like my friends? And then I ordered the stuff on Amazon and filmed it. And then, you know, that was a real idea where every step of the way I was like, I'm having fun. I've had fun filming it. I had fun editing it. Where if anyone knows about editing, that can be a real pain in the ass sometimes.
Yes. It's
very long. I had fun. I was finding myself laughing whilst I was editing it. And that's a real indicator for me to go, is this going to do well? If I laugh at it and I know what's coming, then I think this is going to do well. And what's really funny about it is I put it online and it only done 6,000 views in the day. And I was like, it did 3,000 views off the jump. And I was like, that's not enough for me to go through that process again and do it again. By the time I went to bed, it was like 6,000, 7,000. And I was like, that's enough. I can maybe figure out how to tweak it and stuff like that. That's enough for me to go. I'll do something along those lines again. And when I woke up in the morning, it was on like 150,000 because it had gone across like time zones somehow. So it picked up. And when I woke up in my time zone, it had gone and it just kept going bonkers. And then, yeah, that's when it all really, really took off. And that's when the social media side of things started to work for me. And yeah, there is a divider between how I approach social media and how I approach the stage as well. But most of the thing that holds it all together is that I've got to want to do it. I've got to have fun doing it. It's got to be something where if I put it on now and it doesn't, and it, like I say, it doesn't do 1 million views, it might do 10,000 views. There's things on there recently that I put on that I've done 8,000 views, but it's like, I had fun doing it and everyone knows what I'm trying to do. You know, I've got enough people here now that they know, that one maybe didn't hit, but he's going to come good again, blah, blah, blah. It's fine. We know it. It's like if your favorite musician releases like a, like you're saying, like a whack album, you're like, but then they might release like a six song LP like overnight without, and you're like, what, there's slappers on here. Like, you know, they're going to come good again.
Totally. Amazing.
It gives a lot of freedom. Right now, it's not so much on a knife edge of like, I need this to do well. It's like, no, they know who I, enough people know who I am now to go, oh no, it's fine.
It's one of those things. I wonder if you need to be on, you need to sort of be thinking, I'm going to put this out there and I don't care if it does well, to get to a point where you can use it properly.
Well, it's the same way we approach jokes. When you do new material, and I guess that's the way I've approached it as well, is that when you've got your set and you know it's funny, there's a real comfort in going, I can just do this and make money. But then, you know, there's a burning desire in you to write new stuff. But when you write new stuff, you don't know how the audience is going to take it. This might not be funny. you might just get crickets. There's an excitement and in that of going, I don't know what, this is fun. I don't know what's going to happen. And it's the same with kind of trying to tweak my content of going, I don't know what's going to happen here. Let's just post it and see what happens. But you have to go on stage and you have to go online and go, if it doesn't work, I don't care. I'll just move on to the next one.
Yeah. 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 Nice one. I better move to listener questions because we're on 45 minutes in already. So asking the general public for their opinion, be it on Brexit or boat names, is notoriously fraught with danger. But I'll see if we can sneak three in. I'm going to start with a ridiculous question because it's from my wife and it's referencing your Waze video. And I don't even know if it's possible to answer this. She wants to know, what are the top five things you keep in your favourites?
What, like apps or websites?
I don't know, mate. No, it's that line. It's that line kills her every time. I'm not even going to try and mimic your voice, mate, but I've got it saved in my favourites. That just kills her every time. Every time.
That would be addresses. The funny thing is I probably don't have any address saved in my favourites.
No. I don't know exactly.
Morley's. Shout out to Morley's. You know, you quickly give a quick search in where, you know, especially if you're out of London or something like that. I wonder if they got a Morley's around here.
No, it's a ridiculous question. I'm gonna go to the next one. So we've got a question from Susie. She says, "Where's the line between being funny and being offensive?" We kind of touched on that a bit earlier, right?
The thing is you don't know where the line is until you don't know where the line is until you cross it. You know, you don't know where the landmines are until you step on one and go, oh, I ain't got a leg anymore. And I think, you know, if I can say anything, is that you have to give creative people the space to try and then go, whoops, let me go back to the drawing board and figure out how to make this better. Or, you know, because everyone makes mistakes, and with comedians, nine times out of ten, they're not trying to offend anyone. You got to remember, every single time, you know, nine times out of ten, the only agenda a comedian has is to be funny. The agenda is not to offend anyone. They're trying to be funny, and it didn't work. They're going to go back. They might dump the joke. They go, no, that didn't work. I'm never trying that again. Forget about it. Or they might go, I might be able to figure it out. You know, 20% of the room laughs, so there's something there. I just got to figure out how to get the other 80, or, you know, to get on board with the joke as well. And also, it's open for interpretation. I always use this reference, this idea, is that if we went to the National Art Gallery and looked at a painting, you might go, that's amazing. I might go, that's dog shit. You know, but it's how we see it. And what might be funny to you, Susie, is not funny to somebody else. Or, you know, and everyone's got their lane. But I think if you remember, we're just trying to be funny. Some of us like to tiptoe and tap dance on the line, but some of us are just, you know, go, oh, I went too far there. Let me try again. And it's not real life. That's the main thing to remember. It's not real life. There's a comedian called Ori Styler, and he said one of the best lines I've ever heard. He goes, when you come into a comedy club, when you cross the threshold, we are all together. There's a lot of bad shit happening outside in the world. This, like I said earlier, this is us taking a break from it. We're going to laugh at ourselves. We're going to laugh at our similarities, our differences, our, you know, everything. And then once this show is over, we all got to put on our, you know, our invisible body armor again and go back out and face the world. This is not real life. This is not real.
Yeah, I like that.
Yeah.
Like a contract to say
that. Yeah,
safe space.
Take a break. It's not fucking real. You know, and then once we all go back out there, we all got to worry about our bills, our kids, wars, all of that shit. Yeah, there's so much to worry about, you know. And this is the one thing as well I think about as well, and it's really nuts to think about. With all of that going on, people getting offended, you know, maybe at jokes and then wars and this and politics, bills, not enough money, this, that, the other. You worry about all of that. This sounds nuts when I'm going to say it out loud. There's black holes out in space that at any minute, right, could just go swallow you. It's not a big deal. There's so much more. You're spinning around on this planet in the middle of nowhere. I don't know if anyone else is out there. A black hole can swallow you up. The last thing you're going to think about if the news go, the black hole is coming, is going, that fucking comedian that said that joke. Oh, I hate them. You're going to be like hugging your kids and your family, making amends with people. I'm sorry I called you a wanker that time. You know, it's been, you're going to worry about so much more than what I said, you know?
Yeah. It's a perspective, isn't it? Yeah. Totally. And like you say, you've got a big orange man baby in charge of one part of the world, and you've got a nutter the other side shouting death to the West as he falls asleep, probably.
Don't worry about stand-up comedy. Let's all band together and worry about what the fuck is going on.
Do you think you get away with it a bit more than, say, some comics? Because like you said earlier, you have got that look, that kind of cheekiness to your smile when you tell a joke, and I think that goes a long way with the audience, because you get other comedians like, his name escapes me now, who's that Scottish guy that got cancelled about 5 years ago? He's always on Whose Line Is It Anyway? No, on one of the TV
Frankie
shows
Boyle.
And Frankie Boyle, yeah. And he's just got such a hard delivery, like unapologetically hard, and I feel like that approach, you don't get the tolerance. But ultimately, I side with Ricky Gervais on it. And I know you're a fan of his as well. Like, if you find it offensive, it's not for you, right?
Yeah, turn it off, walk out, no problem. But yeah, I do feel like I get away with it. But so does Jimmy Carr. And people get in the most troubles when they present something that they're not. Look at Bill Cosby, okay? America's dad, clean comedian, used to moan at comedians when they weren't clean, presented himself as this very palatable person, was doing the craziest shit behind closed doors. So then it's a bad example to go, you know, oh, but if you had presented yourself differently, no one would be surprised. That part's a bad example. But the point I'm trying to make is he presented himself to us as someone that is, you know, holier than thou and was doing crazier shit. Whereas if I say to you, hey man, I've been arrested, I've done this, I've got in so much trouble, I was like this in this relationship, I cheated, bloody bloody blah, everyone's gonna go, yeah, we know that's who he said he was, you know what I mean? You know, if politicians come out and say, yeah, I tried drugs at school, then you can't get them, because you told us who you were. Dave Chappelle tells us who he is. Ricky Gervais tells us who he is. But it was, even though I'm a big fan of him, Kevin Hart presented, you know, a very Disney version of himself. Then when he got found cheating, everyone was like, oh, Kevin Hart's a piece of shit, because you pretended to be something you're not. And I think you can get away with more if you are just honest and say, I'm vulnerable and say, this is who I am. Here are the mistakes I've made. You know, the Bill Cosby one was a bad example, but here are the mistakes I've made, and this is who I am now, and this is who I'm trying to be, and bloody, bloody, blah. And people will be much more responsive to you because you haven't lied to them.
Yeah, totally. I think hypocrisy is one of the biggest issues there is, really.
Yeah.
For me. I'm going to try and squeeze one more in, if that's all right with you, Kazim.
Yeah, as many as you want, man.
So Dan says, how do you track success? What does that look and feel like?
Obviously, financially, can I bring in the funds? Am I being successful at this? Is enough people paying me? Or am I making enough money and being successful to continue doing this? There's success online, like I said, going, right, I've set a goal and now I've got an audience. That is the way I look at success and going, I did that. There's success in going, here's a new joke. Did they laugh? Yes, that was a success. I did it. I did it again. Wicked. Cool. So on the other side, there's success in going, this joke hasn't worked for 6 months, and then you figure it out and you go, well, I figured it out and now it's funny. There's success in that. The way I track it is that saying of going, if you can figure out a way to do what you love doing, then you'll never work a day in your life. And it sounds a bit cliche or a bit corny, but like that is very true. There's so many times I've come off stage and been like, that wasn't work. That even like when people say you got work tonight, I'm like, no, what? I'm going on stage. I'm telling a couple of dick jokes, and I don't know how this is working out. I don't know how this is happening, but it's happening. I work for 20 to 40 minutes a night, and you know, it's cool. And that's my main thing, really, is that I want to how I will track my success is that, can I find a way to finance and all of the ideas in my head and continue to do live stand-up comedy and without having an actual job? Can I do all of that and all the things I want to achieve? Can I get enough money so that I can continue doing the stuff that I love, really? Not, can I get enough money to buy a Mercedes? Can I get enough money to buy a massive house? Can I get enough money to do, can I get enough money where everything's taken care of? I don't have to worry about it. I might not be super rich, but I don't have to worry. And I can go, here's an idea, let's make it. Or here's a tour idea, let's make it. Or, you know, whatever. Because
back to the control thing, right?
Yeah.
And freedom and control.
What I am is almost, I don't think I'm a stand-up comedian per se. Along with sports, all throughout my life, I've just had ideas. I think I'm someone that, I feel like I'm a creator that does stand-up comedy primarily. Like stand-up is my love, but there's other things I want to create. There's other ideas. There's other things I want to do. But at the core of it is live stand-up. And that was how I will be able to measure my success, is how many of these ideas did I get out of my head and present to people.
Nice. I should just add that you've just back from 6 weeks on the road. Well, I say the road, you're on the sea for some of it.
On the sea,
right?
Yeah.
How can our listeners see you? Because you're touring again now, aren't you? I mean, you're in Reading where we are in a couple of weeks, right?
Yeah, I try to stay on top of my dates. There's a link in my Instagram bio on my Facebook profile. There's a link. If you click that link, you will say live dates. So yeah, back out there, primarily the UK. More often than not, I'll be coming to somewhere in your near area. But Instagram is the main place. I respond to anyone that messages me. I respond to them 100%, unless some people try and say foolishness and tell you jokes and stuff like that, and you might start going, okay. But people want to talk about football, people want to talk about jokes, people want to talk about films, I'm like, yeah, let's talk. So if you want to actually reach out, definitely give me a message on Instagram.
Well, we're going to link in the listing so our listeners now can have a look in the listing. We're going to have a few of your videos there. I'm going to start with the Waze one. I'm not going to say it's your best work, but I think it's your best work.
Wicked.
The view count might disagree, right? But it's I've lost count how many people I've sent it to.
But that's the beauty of it, is that you think you love it as the number one video, and someone might go, I prefer Frozen. I don't know. Like, it's that's the beauty of it, is that everyone's got their favorites. You know what I mean?
Frozen is a gem, by the way. It's a gem. Some of the pertinent poses we usually end with probably aren't as applicable, but I am going to put the last one to you, Kazim, which is, we always dedicate every episode to someone, and we bestow or hospital pass that honor depending on your view to our guest, who has to give the reason why. Would you dedicate this episode to somebody?
I dedicate this show to my mum for the support, the endless support. I dedicate this show to my dad. You taught me a lot without, you know, being there. My dad was not in my life at all, really. So those are the things I draw on what kind of man I want to be, and I've got me this far. Primarily to my son, but to the kids, this gives you another thing to work hard for. And lastly, anyone that told me, stop mucking around, you can't be a clown for the rest of your life. That's
amazing.
Quick dedication for you. Yeah, you were wrong.
Amazing. Brilliant. That's a great mix of dedications. Well said.
Yeah.
Well said.
And big shout out to anyone that supports me. Yeah.
Nice one. So a final call to action then to our listeners. Again, just check out the listing. We've shared links to everything we've discussed. The Frozen video will be there too. We're going to share the links to sign up to the mailing list. I do urge you to check out where Kazim is performing. And if you can't get to a show, just get on his Instagram. But how else can our listeners get more Kazim?
Now that I'm back from being abroad, I've got one more trip abroad. But like I said, I've got a lot of ideas. So I'm really going to start focusing on YouTube. So if you could, even though there's not much on there now, if you are listening, do me a favor and give my YouTube a subscribe. You know, there's a lot of sketch comedy and just kind of like content that will allow you to know me a bit better, and that's just fun. So Instagram, mailing list, YouTube. But yeah, just give me on any platform, just give me a message. I make it one of my main things to get back to anyone that's taking the time out to follow me or message me. And if you see me out and about, even though I might be frowning, because I've been told I always frown, do come up to me, man. I might pass it off as like, oh, well, thanks so much, man. I love it. That's the narcissistic side of me.
I need to take an hour to show it.
Yeah, I go over to my fam. I'm like, you see that? I'm a big deal. Did you see that? Yeah. Even though the other day in IKEA, someone referenced me as that funny guy. Didn't know my name. I was like, yep, that's me. You see that?
That feels like a stepping stone to where you're going to be, though, right?
Yeah.
I think everyone has to go through that first stepping stone.
Oh, yeah, for sure. But no, it's not lost on me. If anyone does recognize me and, you know, do come and say hello, I do. It's more I joke about it, but I do really appreciate it, because you never know. You never know if this thing is going to work out. And if anyone's listening, that's my main thing. It's just, like I say, anything could happen at any time in this crazy world. Just have fun, man.
Yeah. Love it. Well, that's a perfect point to end on. So listen, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a real pleasure, mate.
No, thank you for having me, man. Appreciate it.
Finally, thank you to everyone listening. If you've enjoyed the episode, please share and review the pod. Keep your questions and guest requests coming in. To get in touch, it's easy to find Gasp online or email the mouthful, that is calltoaction@gasp.agency.
To action, I can't get no call to action, but I try, and I try, and I try, and I try. Yeah, hey, hey.